Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Will Clark, Senior Communication Studies major and videographer at Gustavus, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me, your host, Greg Castor. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College. There's always a way to make a connection between things that seem really unrelated at first, observes my colleague, Professor Yuri Hong of the Gustavus Classics Department. The ability to make those connections is what enables people to adapt and to come up with creative and collaborative solutions. My goal is to help students make those connections between people, cultures, and ideas. No matter what you do, your life and your work will be enriched if you can make those connections. As you will hear in this conversation, in addition to making connections in her teaching and scholarship, Yuri more recently has been making them as well across two spheres traditionally seen as quite separate and even incompatible, namely academia and activism. Academic Yuri received her PhD in classics from the University of Washington, Seattle in 2007 and joined the Gustavus Classics Department that year, where she teaches ancient Greek language, history, and culture, as well as courses on sex, gender, and reproduction in antiquity. She has authored numerous scholarly publications and conference presentations, served as chair of her department as well as the planning committee for the 2017 Gustavus Nobel Conference on Reproductive Technologies, and participated in a National Endowment for the Humanities Summer Institute on Facing Death in Ancient Greece. Activist Yuri has most notably founded and led Indivisible St. Peter since January 2017, served on the board of Minnesota Indivisible Alliance since late 2018, and co-authored a successful Blandon Foundation grant for, quote, supporting diversity and leadership initiatives in rural communities. In April 2020, the YWCA of Mankato, Minnesota, recognized the community impact of her social justice activism and leadership with a much-deserved Woman of Distinction Award. It's no exaggeration to say that she is one of the most admired and respected members of the Gustavus faculty, and I am delighted to have this opportunity to speak with her about her work both on campus and in the broader community. Welcome, Yuri. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Hi. Thanks, Greg. It's really great to be here.
Wonderful. I'm glad we could do this. Let's start at the beginning. You're really a historian. A classicist has to be a historian. Let's start with your own history, if you would. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your path to classics.
Yeah. Well, my parents moved to Los Angeles in the 70s from South Korea. And so my sisters and brother and I were all born in Los Angeles and grew up there and lived there for, you know, most of our lives. And I was a pretty quiet kid. I didn't have a ton of friends. My sisters were my friends. So I read a lot. And I remember when I was young, my older sister had a mythology project that she had to do for school. I think she was in fifth grade, so that would have made me third grade. And I remember that she had to draw a picture of the underworld with all the different myths, and she was explaining what she was drawing, and I was just fascinated. I loved the stories. I loved all the different gods. I thought it made a ton of sense that there were these kind of chaotic, powerful beings, and that's why life was so chaotic and uncertain and unfair. Yeah. So I remember reading, going to the library and wanting more and more stories, and I checked out all of these books. And then after a while, I realized that there were different versions of the same stories, like Zeus. Some books said that Zeus had different wives, and some said that he had lots of girlfriends. And I remember thinking, like, well, which one is it? Because that makes a really big difference about how, you know, how we're supposed to view him. Were these legitimate, sanctioned, you know, relationships, and there were marriages, and that was just a thing that was okay? Or, you know, was he not supposed to be running around on his wife and he was having lots of girlfriends, because that's kind of wrong? And so what's the deal, and why can't they get their story straight? So really early on, I was interested in kind of these questions of what's the original source say? Why are there different versions of things? What do these different versions mean? And I was pretty nerdy about it. And, you know, that kind of manifested in other areas of my life as well, in terms of like musical theater and things like that. Oh. But we can talk about that later. So yeah, I remember reading all these myths, and I became more familiar with ancient Greece and Rome. And by the time I got to college, the very first class that I took at UCLA was a class on Greek history and civilization. or culture, I should say. And I found that I was raising my hand in class, which I never, ever, ever did. So I realized that there was something here and I probably should stick with it. And I kept taking classics classes. And after a while, a couple of years into school, my mom was like, well, what are you going to do with your life? What career do you want to pursue? And I had some really amazing teachers in high school. I thought, well, you know, teaching seems good, a worthwhile way to spend one's life. And so she said, well, if you're going to teach, then at least get a PhD and teach at the college level. And I had never really thought about that. And I was like, well, okay. And so what would I need to do that? And then I researched that a bit and realized that I needed to take languages. And I figured, well, if I'm not good at this or I don't like it, then I better find out fast. So I enrolled in Greek, which had the reputation of being harder. I think it's not actually harder, but because there's a different alphabet, people get intimidated by it. So I enrolled in intensive Greek over the summer and figured I would just, you know, jump right in and give myself a chance to switch if I didn't like it or if it didn't work out. And, you know, I was okay at it. And then I passed and I think I got a B, which was pretty good.
Good.
I had never taken an ancient language before and I didn't really know what I was doing or how to study properly. And then when I took Latin in the fall, the following fall was when things all clicked and then they started working together. And I've noticed that I was actually working a lot harder than I needed to, mostly because I wanted to be absolutely sure that I understood everything. And so there again, it was, because I'm kind of, to be honest, I'm a little bit like lazy and self-indulgent, especially as a student, I would kind of get away with the least that I could do. And so with classics, because I ended up doing more than I needed to do, because I really, really wanted to figure it out and learn it, I figured I should stick with that and give myself the best chance of being good at something.
So you're one of these people who knew going into college what you, I mean, I don't know that you knew for sure you wanted to be a classics major, but you went in already with a strong interest. And I love these stories, as I've said many times in these podcast interviews, because they highlight contingency. I mean, what if your sister hadn't had that project, right? But you mentioned some of your high school teachers. Were you able to sort of nourish your interest in mythology, ancient mythology in high school? Or was that something that kind of you had to do on your own?
Yeah, you know, it manifested in different ways. And so certainly in English, my English class was, I had a really great English teacher. Her name was Montserrat Fontes. She was a Mexican-American woman, and she had us read all kinds of things that were outside of the general list. And so certainly my knowledge of classics really helped, because I understood a lot of these allusions or references. And, you know, when we read Toni Morrison, you know, there's a lot of classical references there. So that certainly helped. I took this amazing AP art history class. And so the mythological references and figures in art helped as well. And so it was a useful framework for understanding, because classics is so interdisciplinary. You know, there's history, there's art, there's literature. It kind of was a useful, background for all these other works of art and cultural products that refer back to ancient Greece and Rome. And so it was useful in that sense. But it did, I think classics is part of a larger love and interest for me in terms of how do people think? How do they organize themselves? How do they process their emotions and relationships? And that's something you can get from any culture and any cultural product. For me, it happened with classics. So I think for anyone, it could be anything else. There's a lot of value to all of it.
Yeah, I so often wish I had pursued my interest in. I guess I wouldn't have known to call it classics, but in the mythology, I had a great high school history teacher, really, but we read, who would it have been? Joseph, Oh, Joseph Campbell, right? I think we maybe read some of him. And then, you know, my dad's side, you may remember, I'm Greek American. And so my father would occasionally drop like Zeus or whatever. I mean, just into the Socrates, into the conversation. Anyway, and as you're already suggesting this, it seems to encompass all the good and the bad about life. I mean, just every aspect of life is in the myths, which makes them so fascinating and fun. So you went to the University of Washington, Seattle, and what was your area of, I mean, you were obviously pursuing a PhD in classics, but with a particular focus?
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually started out, so after I graduated from UCLA, I took a year off and taught middle school, 7th and 8th grade Latin at Crossroads School in Santa Monica, which was really fascinating.
Oh, I didn't know you did that. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I loved it. And it forever shaped the way that I think about teaching. And so, and I always knew that I was going to go to grad school. I was just taking a year in between so that I could apply. I was studying abroad at the time. I should have been applying and I didn't want to apply from abroad. So
were you in Greece?
No, I was in England, actually, in Exeter for my junior year abroad. And so I took a little bit of time to kind of save up a little bit of money and gain a little bit of teaching experience, and then also have the time to really research where I wanted to go to grad school. So, University of Washington in Seattle, I really thought carefully about where I wanted to go. And the program there was very well balanced in terms of Greece and Rome, in terms of the different kinds of focuses the different faculty had. It was half male, half female. It was a pretty stable faculty so that they weren't, you know, I wasn't going to come for one person and then have that person leave.
Right.
And so I went in knowing that whatever I was interested in, I would probably change my mind based on other things that I would encounter, because even though I had majored in classics, I knew that it was a much broader field than I was going to be able to get an introduction to in undergrad. So that's why I wanted to keep all of my options open. And I think I probably went in thinking I was going to do something on tragedy or something. And I kind of did, but it got broader and more specific at the same time.
Tell us a little bit about your dissertation, your PhD research, what it focused on.
Yeah, so it was interesting. When I started grad school, I was like, well, I'm not going to do women just because I'm a woman. And I ended up, and then eventually I made my way around to, well, just because I'm a woman doesn't mean I can't do women. I ended up doing my dissertation on representations of pregnancy and childbirth in Greek literature. And that topic I became interested in that topic, to be honest, because there was this ER episode that I saw my first year in grad school. And at the very end, this man and this woman come in and, you know, the woman's in labor and they've got a bunch of kids already, so no one's nervous about it. And then one thing, and then, you know, there's this cool couple that everyone likes, but then one thing after another goes wrong. And then the episode ends with the father holding his newborn son, I think it was, and then someone coming to say, like, I'm really sorry your wife just died. And I remember being like, oh my God, I never want to give birth ever. But also I just like that was burned on my brain, this kind of like, oh my God, like what would that be like to be holding new life, you know, like this is your newborn child, and then also to be grieving the loss of your life partner, and what would that be like to, you know, there's something really kind of primal and elemental about it, that there's life and death, and even, you know, even with modern medicine, there's always the threat of death, right, of the mother or the child. And the U.S. still has pretty unacceptably high maternal mortality rates and everything. So it doesn't matter, you know, what time you're living in. This is something you think about. And so I was interested in exploring that. And that topic allowed me to kind of be as interdisciplinary as possible. I didn't want to nail myself down to one author or one genre. It was hard enough to nail down to Greece. I actually wanted to do Greece and Rome, but that's too big. So I focused a little bit on epic poetry. There's a chapter on on tragedy. There's a chapter on medical texts. There's a chapter on Herodotus and historiography. So this topic enabled me to play around in all of those different areas.
I just love, again, the the contingencies, right? So your sister, an episode of ER. it's just great. That sounds like maybe a Greek tragedy or something, elements of it, that episode. You've continued this research in as you've gone on into motherhood, gender, reproduction, birth, and tell us a little bit about some of the, so what did you find, or what have you found as you've looked at representations of motherhood and reproduction in Greek, ancient Greek literature?
Something that I was really reflecting on, I wrote a book chapter on motherhood in ancient Athens, kind of thinking about, envisioning, imagining, comparing the mothering experience, perhaps, right, for women of different classes and statuses. So elite Athenian women versus enslaved women versus, kind of working class Athenian citizen women. And I was writing it while my two kids were very young. And I remember reflecting on the one hand, we have a presentist kind of bias where everything is so much better now and everything in the past was terrible. But the more I sat down to really think about it, the more it became clear that actually being stuck in a house with just your nuclear family and with small children, that's harder, and trying to do your work at the same time is harder in a very different setup than in kind of pre-industrialized societies, where you would have a lot of people, you're in a community, a lot of people would be watching out for all of the kids. They're running around, wreaking havoc, but also being with each other and being socialized and, have a greater range of freedom of movement. And these are all very large generalizations, but just it got me thinking about family structures and household structures, I should say. More clearly. And again, as I was saying before, that, maternal mortality is maybe not as bad as it, or maybe not as quite as dangerous as it might have been for ancient Greek women, where they didn't have birth control. And the more children you have, the more risks there are, going forward. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that there's zero risk for us today. And it doesn't mean that there aren't areas that we can improve. So I think one of the things that I always think about with classics and thinking about ancient people and cultures, or people from just any different place or time or geographic location, even if it's present day, is that there's some things that are similar and some things that are different. And we have to keep both of those things in mind, and they may be different proportions, but.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm thinking, as you're speaking, I'm thinking of, I think it's David Lowenthal, who's a historian and geographer, who wrote about the past as a foreign country. I think that's the title of his classic book. But yeah, the ways we need to understand that people in the past are in some ways like us and vice versa, but also different, and try not to veer toward one pole or the other. I think that's really hard, but I think that's at the heart of history. And by the way, there's some recent stuff. I haven't read it. I just have read reviews in early American history, in 19th century U.S. history, about representations of motherhood. And I'm curious. I mean, so are women? Are you finding women are being glorified as mothers? I mean, are there references to the dangers of motherhood, the loss of children, in the literature you've looked at?
Absolutely, there is. There's certainly, if you look at tombstones especially, there's certainly acknowledgement of the dangers of motherhood. And there's a famous book or book chapter by Nicole Leroux about called Mothers in Mourning. And it talks about women, well, mothers and their relationship to either death and dying, or in childbirth, or in mourning the dead, right? Dead children, dead husbands, and things like that. And that the very much, and we're talking about Athenian citizen women, that very much the way for a woman to be honored or respected or gain status is through her relationships, through her children, primarily, I would say, even more than her husband. Husband too, but kind of, you know, as the mother of Heracles, for example, or the mother of people who have done great things for a city, or the mother of heroes, that it's their motherhood that causes them to be honored because that's where they came from. Mm. But there's also, you see there's some challenges too later on when citizenship laws change, where or become more specific, where then mothers become like a weak link in the chain sometimes, where there weren't citizenship records or anything. And so, you know, but for men, they would be, you know, specifically enrolled in their, you know, enrolled and registered as a citizen and a son of their father, who's a citizen and all of that. And for women, there wasn't quite that. So sometimes you see in the law court, in the law cases that mothers become this point of, you know, where it's like, oh, well, your mother wasn't really a citizen, or wasn't the daughter of a citizen, so therefore you're not really a citizen, and so you can't bring this lawsuit against me. And, you know, and so they become a contested site for citizenship when that
citizenship
deal. So it's a kind of it's a tricky thing, shall we say, but definitely motherhood is a route towards respectability, honor, and so there's a, you know, in the same way today, right? We also have kind of idealized ideas of motherhood, and that gets people extra brownie points for being like the best mom, or, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So how did the risks of childbirth and the death of children, how did those themes manifest themselves in the literature you looked at?
I think mostly what I was interested in was the use of this idea, right? The power and the vulnerability of birth or birthing as a metaphor for literary production. And it becomes really powerful as an actual concrete fact, but also in terms of like the image in, for example, Euripides' Trojan Women. And so thinking about what it means for a city to die and for people of that city to no longer be able to be born as Trojans. And so the Trojan women are waiting to be, you know, Troy has fallen, the men have been killed, and the Trojan women are waiting to be parceled out to their Greek captors. And so there's a lot of reflecting on the causes of the war, the origins, the causes of trouble in general for Troy. And then there's this really horrifying and powerful song in the middle where they envision that they're going to go to their different spots in Greece and they're going to give birth to Greek sons. And that's the final death of Troy. And so, and this is also, you know, we know that rape is part of, it's another way that war gets perpetrated on women's bodies on purpose. It's another form of genocide, using reproduction, using birth as a form of, as a tool or weapon of genocide and death. So again, this birth and death thing. And they become kind of like the Trojan horses, right? The Trojan horse comes in pregnant with armed men that destroy the city. And there's, I could go on about this for a while.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Oh, I never thought about the Trojan horse as pregnant. Yes. That makes
sense. It says pregnant with armed men. And, you know, and so that imagery is already there. And then what morphs into, you know, so this meditation on the actual material consequences of war for women, especially captive women, then morphs into the birth instead of the, like, we begin to witness like the birth of oral epic or storytelling or mourning, lament about the Trojan War. And so it's this kind of like circular thing where they're giving birth to the lament songs about Troy that turn into the epics that then become glorious songs to commemorate that. And so you have immortal song as a replacement for the mortal bodies and the mortal city. And so those are the kinds of things that I was particularly interested in that chapter. with regard to the themes of birth and death and the dangers of that. I think it just becomes a really powerful, the reality of it becomes a powerful symbol for other things.
And as you suggested earlier too, this is all about connections. I mean, the connections between what women are experiencing then, as mothers, as birth givers, and in death as well. And now, I mean, there are differences, as you've also said, but there are also connections and similarities. That goes back to the opening quote I read, which I love. And that leads me to ask you a bit about, Gustavus. So you have a PhD in classics from a major university program, and why Gustavus? Why, was it simply that's what the job market offered, or were you looking specifically to be at a liberal arts college? What brought you to Gustavus?
I would say, I mean, yes, if the job market gives you a job, you take it. My husband and I were fortunate actually that we actually had a choice.
Sean Easton, your husband. Yeah.
Yes.
Also in classics.
Yes. Also in department. And, we got the job offer at Gustavus, but then we also got a job offer at Arizona State University, which is where we were at for, I was there for a year and he was there for 2 years. And it really wasn't that hard of a choice. ASU certainly offered a lot more money, but Gustavus offered everything else that we wanted, which was a community, an ethos that was more in line with how we felt about teaching, community research, and how you balance all of those things. The type of quality of life or family life we wanted to have. And ASU was just its opposite in every way. So it wasn't really so much of a choice, or it wasn't a hard decision, I should say. And I have to admit, I was a little apprehensive about coming from Los Angeles and Seattle and then moving to St. Peter.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Go ahead. Yeah.
I stepped into River Rock. Wilfred took me to River Rock on my way out of town from my
local coffee shop that we all love.
River Rock Coffee. And yeah. I remember walking in, and it felt so much like a kind of, you know, homey neighborhood Seattle coffee shop. But I was like, okay, I can do this. Like, yeah, it'll be fine if it's got a place like this. And it was... And it's worked out really well for us.
Yeah, I know that Kate Wittenstein, my wife, you know, Kate, who recently retired from the history department, grew up in New York City, and I grew up in the burbs of Chicago, and both city people met in Boston, and we came, like you and Sean, we were hired jointly at the time, which Gustavus had, I think, a pretty good track record of doing for couples. In any case, and I remember thinking, oh my God, I don't know, you know, from Boston to St. Peter, and there was no River Rock at that point, you know, no movie theater, no nothing. It was, oh, can we do this? But yeah, we could do it. And definitely the point about community, the community among the faculty, and also crossing lines, I mean, faculty, staff, administrators, students, it's really, really powerful. And Kate did go to a small liberal arts college. I did not. Mm-hmm. went to a big state school and then a big private university, Boston University, where we met. In any case, we're glad you and Sean came to an R. Gustavus. You've been teaching courses in classics and also doing some interdisciplinary work with other faculty and other departments. But you've also become, especially in recent years, an activist. I mean, you've been quite involved in what I would call social justice activism, or community-based activism, correct me. But tell us a little bit about that transition, if it is a transition. I mean, how have you found yourself moving into activism? Because my sense is you weren't doing it early on at Gustavus. Go ahead.
No. I'm embarrassed to say that I was not involved.
And I didn't mean that, by the way.
I like being upfront about this because I think it's important. It's not a stable identity that some people are kind of born activists, and some people stumble upon it and, you know, become inspired or moved or impelled to do it. And I think that with a lot of things in life, you do things that you're ready for. And I think Gustavus and some of the relationships that I've been fortunate to have here has been actually 100% instrumental in my taking this path. I don't know that I would have done this if I'd been somewhere else, like in LA, for example. But basically, my second year at Gustavus, I'd heard from other faculty members at about my level that, you can sit in on people's classes sometimes and things like that. So Elisa Rosenthal from the poli-sci department, she's no longer at Gustavus, but she was a huge, influence and presence on campus when she was here, and she was in poli-sci, and I'd heard all these great things about her, and she was right in my building. And so I kind of drummed up the courage to kind of be like, hey, can I sit in on your sex, power, and politics class? Because I actually had never taken any women's studies or any kinds of classes like that in college. And so, I wanted to learn from her because I'd heard from students that she was so amazing. And I was like, well, what's so amazing? And how do I learn some of that? And so she let me sit in on that class. And it was obviously related to my own research interests and everything, because it focused on a lot of things, forced sterilization, reproductive politics, and things like that. So, but in the modern era. So I was there for many reasons. And one of the things that she always emphasized in her class for students was like, it's not scary to go out and do things. They had to do some kind of, project that was action-based and not just consciousness raising. And I remember, this constant refrain of like, you don't just have to think about stuff. You have to go do things. Otherwise it doesn't, not that it doesn't count, but it's really important that you translate your thoughts into actions of some kind. And I remember really sitting there and being a student in that class and learning a ton, but also being really inspired to go out and do things. But I don't think I really knew what that meant. And I kind of sectioned that off and figured that was like more for students to do. And the same things I tell students to get involved or to go out and make their ideas count in the world and everything. That's what I viewed my role as being on the front end, the cheerleader of the coach for that, not a practitioner myself. And then, because of that class, I submitted as a suggestion for the Nobel conference, the topic of reproductive technologies, again, not because it had anything to do directly with my area of expertise, because that's all modern and forward-looking, but because it was something I was like, hey, this would be a cool thing to think about. Science and a lot of ethical stuff. So, and then a few years later, they were like, oh, your topic has come up, so it's your turn. And I was really daunted. But because there was an infrastructure in place for planning, and I was only responsible for a portion of it, like the shaping of the topic and the running of the committee meetings to decide on speakers and that kind of thing, I was able to see, firsthand, I was able to be a part of the planning and coordinating, but didn't have to do a lot of the kind of the really big picture logistical stuff, but I got to see how that all came together.
And it was a great conference too. I remember it well. It was fantastic.
It was so much fun. To kind of be a part of the behind the scenes was really amazing and empowering to be like, oh, the reason that our conference was took the shape that it did was because there were humanities people on that committee. Like, for example, we had folks from biology but we also had the, Madeline and Marinari in your department, in the history department, right, was also there. And so, there was a really good mix of people kind of guiding that discussion about, how do we construe this topic? And it kind of came at this perfect time because 2017, by the 2016 election, we were a year into planning. And then, but it wasn't 2017.
Right. The election had not occurred.
Yeah, we were halfway through the planning. And so I already had a year's worth of, this is how things go and how you plan a big project and how you get people on board to join the committee, or, how you keep people involved and interested, even if they're not going to commit to the committee, but they're interested in the topic. And then maybe later on they'll do something else that is connected to the conference, or they're more liable to, if they've been kind of lurking in the background and hearing about how things are going, they're more interested in it'll occur to them, I should say, to include stuff in their classes that would connect. And so those kinds of things were really helpful, because then once the 2016 election happened, and I realized just for myself that it's not enough to just know about things and talk about them, for me anyway. And I do want to recognize all the different contributions and life stages that people are at. But for me, I realized that I was sitting on a lot of skills that I had acquired through being a teacher and through being this, you know, head of the planning committee, that I could also put to some kind of productive use. Now at my, and that's when I started Indivisible St. Peter Greater Mankato. We merged with Indivisible Mankato, merged with us a bit later on. And I really, I was envisioning at first, it was like, you know, that maybe there would be a collection of like 50 people, you know, me and some people that I knew, and I'd make handouts and send emails, and I know how to call a meeting. I know how to send out meeting minutes. I know how to organize a Google Drive folder, and I'm pretty organized about that. And I know how to, you know, kind of recognize like when people are interested but busy, and I'll get back to them, or people are really not interested and I'm not going to bother them anymore. So it was really, it hasn't been that big of a shift. It's different, certainly, but it, you know, this is what we mean when we say transferable skills.
Right.
You know, I mean, like reading an article, summarizing it, posting it on Facebook, pulling relevant quotes, that's not that different in some ways from my training as an academic. And so while I wish on some level that I had been involved sooner in my life, I also know that I spent my life thinking and learning and training in some ways that I didn't know how I was going to use my skills. And then I had the skills and experiences, and then I could just point them in this direction and it could take off. So there's a lot. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I did in my day job that I've been able to transfer rather efficiently over, I think.
I think it fits so well with what you said a couple of minutes ago, a phrase I love so much I jotted it down, which is you do things that you were ready for, you were ready. And I also love, I mean, you know, there's this sense, I did my graduate training at Boston University where Howard Zinn mm-hmm. was there. One of my first experiences was the faculty, essentially a general strike at Boston University. You know, the faculty, the clerical workers. It was amazing, against the then president John Silber, or as he was sometimes called, the Shah of Boston. In any case, there was Howard Zinn. I didn't have a class with him, but you know, he was such a model of thinking, but also acting, and not seeing them as opposed. And in your case, I love the fact that it's sitting in on a class taught by a colleague, right, that inspires you, and that it's your work on the Nobel Conference Planning Committee that helps you sort of realize, you know, the skills you have. I mean, that is a form of activism. I would argue teaching is, at least can be, a form of activism as well. So I think, yeah, you were ready, and the time was right for you. The you touched on this briefly, but let's talk a little bit about how your work as an academician and your work and maybe even identities, both cases, as an activist, I mean, how they inform one another. And I don't mean in some crude way for our listeners who are about to say, oh, you see, tenured radicals. I don't mean in some crude way that you go out and bring political ideas into the classroom to force on students, but rather in other ways, how do the two inform each other? Do you think much about that?
I do. I think about it a lot. And I mostly think about it in terms of narratives, and in terms of how that narrative shifts depending on how you look at it. And so I'm going to get a little bit personal here. You know, one of the, because I like these connections, right? And one of the things I've really appreciated about classics is that it's given me all these skills and all of that. But I think what really pulled at me early on as a kid, but also as a young adult, right, as a college student, was that I could make these connections between these ancient Greeks and Romans with stuff I was wrestling with in my personal life. So I remember reading Antigone, again, it was like the first month of college. And there's one part where one character, Haemon, is fighting with his dad, and his dad is being very strict and unyielding. And he says, the tree that doesn't bend in the storm will break, and the sail that doesn't loosen against the wind is going to tear. And I remember I put exclamation points in the margin saying, yes, because my parents were very, to my mind, strict and unyielding. and so that was something I always appreciated and thought, how cool that there are these words some Greek guy wrote 2,500 years ago, and I find some resonance in them. But classics has helped me think about, has helped me process other things in my life, like the death of my brother, for example, but also understanding my grandmother and trying to process how she fits into my story and vice versa. And, my grandmother came to the U.S. when my sister was born, and she was, she had an arranged marriage when she was in South Korea, and she and my grandfather were both in their teens. And, in a lot of ways, her life mirrored, there were a lot more parallels with her life and ancient Greek women's lives than what I can actually fully comprehend and emotionally understand. And she did all of the things that you're supposed to. She was quiet. She did all the cooking and the cleaning and the watching kids. And even in our house, we loved her like crazy. But that's what she was for us. We couldn't have long extended conversations. We weren't close in that way, but we were physically, very emotionally close to her. And I've always felt a little bit guilty about, or not guilty, but her experience does not map onto what American, what Americans value in terms of heroism or fighting against systems or being loud and having your voice heard and all of this kind of thing. The things that we, what is that? Like women who don't break the rules, don't make history, or well-behaved women.
Right.
And she was a very well-behaved woman. And so how do we square that with, is that wrong? Is that right? And all of this. And so I think about that a lot. And in class, one of the, I remember there were some students and they were, very feminist, as I am, very feminist as well. But there was a lot of kind of condemnation of ancient Greek culture, that's so sexist, and these women's lives they were treated as worthless, and all they were baby-making machines and all this kind of thing. And I was like, how would you feel if an ancient Greek woman was in this room hearing you talk about her life this way? I'm not saying anything I disagreed with, certainly, but at the same time, it was not respectful of the lives of that lots of women live. And there's reasons why people are invested in certain ways of living that maybe we don't agree with. And so the ability, even if you disagree with it and you can see the structures, I am furious at the patriarchal systems or whatever that shaped my grandmother's life such that she didn't have any choices. And both of those things can be true at the same time. And right. So in terms of activism, I think it's really hard sometimes to see the humanity in others. And I don't think that, I think we do need to be careful and always center the humanity of people who have been dehumanized for generations or dehumanized in their current life. At the same time, for me, what's important is trying to figure out why are people the way they are? How do we convince, or not convince, but how do we think through how we're going to deal with anyone based on where they're at, based on what is the humane, kind, generous, but also effective thing to do? There's a practical element of it as well. And I think activism is all about it's about words, it's about ideas, it's about relationships and maintaining some kind of humane connection to people such that the systems work better and more in a more just way. That's what, for me, being an academic has helped me think through a lot of that.
Yeah, because I think everything you've just said about being an activist is also relevant to being a successful teacher. Trying to figure out where the students are, trying to understand who they are, meeting them where they are, not necessarily staying there with them and having them stay where they are. But all of that is, as you said earlier, transferable to activism and vice versa. What about at some other levels? Are there ways in which your activism, you find yourself consciously or unconsciously drawing on your experiences as an activist in your teaching?
In my teaching?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that in my teaching, I don't talk about Indivisible and my activist work off campus in the classroom. I will talk about American democracy and its relationship to, or its various types of relationships to classical Athenian democracy. I will talk about the systems. I will talk, and the branches of government and why that's important to know. And I will bring in contemporary events that students, that will impact students' lives and why they should know about it and encourage them to get involved. But I don't do recruiting or active discussion of my work in that area in the classroom. But I do kind of all of the things that I mentioned already about helping students navigate differences of opinion or imagine a different life and how maybe the constrainment of options explains why people live the lives that they do or struggle against the societal structures that they do without changing the structures and help them see how those different stories change over time. And myth is actually perfect for that because myth can, they're like jewels you hold up to the light, you turn it one way and then it casts a different kind of spectrum of colors. You turn it another way and then you can't see them at all. And so that's why you have so many different versions of Heracles or Hercules, where he's the bad guy or he's the buffoon or he's the hero and so I think one of the most important things I can do in terms of in the classroom is helping students understand the stories that we tell and understand that myth and history or the news, these don't function differently, just because they're different genres or types of information. They're still narratives. And so the ability to understand the narrative as it changes and to interrogate, your sources and who's speaking at the time and all of that is and how that narrative changes if you kind of adopt the perspective of a different character is really important. And that's where my activism comes into the classroom is the, helping students question narratives and really think about what they want their role to be in the story they tell about their own lives.
Music to my ears, I'm thinking as a historian and the way we talk about, collective memory and narrative stories, or what narrative, for example, of the U.S. Civil War is dominant at a particular time? How is that narrative being challenged? And yeah, I think, also this idea that, well, that all happened in the past, right? It's not really relevant to now. No, it's incredibly relevant, whether it's the ancient world or history 100 years ago. It's the legacies are all around us in both obvious ways and not so obvious. I think especially of people in this country who say, well, slavery, that ended in, more than 100 years ago. Well, yeah, but its legacies continue. And some of those legacies are complicated, right? I mean, they're not, it's not just one terrible story. I mean, legacies of music and food, for example. In any case, boy, I wish I'd been a classics major. Maybe there's still time. I can sit in on one of your classes. Now, one of the things, switching gears here a bit, one of the things students know about you and I know about you is your love, which I share, your love of the musical Alexander Hamilton. Could you tell us a little bit about what it is about that musical that grabs you?
Oh, there's so many things. The music's awesome. The story's awesome. It's so layered. But I teach it in my myth class in part because it's great and I think everyone should listen to it. But also because it's so complex that it's really useful for talking about origin stories and historical myth. And it complicates this idea that, you know, myth was what we had before we had history. And now we have history that's based on facts. And so myth is not something people believe anymore. And that's actually not true. And a myth isn't a lie. It's not a bunch of things right. people believe that aren't true. Myth is actually a compelling narrative that people recognize and that holds meaning for people, whether they think that they're true or not. It kind of transcends that. And so I love Hamilton because it's very conscious about its own myth making, right? Who lives, who dies, who tells your story.
Yes.
Eliza saying, you know, I'm taking myself out of the narrative. Now I'm putting myself back in the narrative. And, you know, it deals with sources, you know, because
right.
the letters, so now we don't have them. And, you know,
yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's incredible.
It's like begging, it's crying out for dissertations. Like,
right.
yeah. Like it's just, it's all been very intentionally and carefully put in there. And so I'm not so interested in the way that ancient myths show up or are represented in modern works. I'm actually interested in connecting two seemingly unconnected dots. And so what I love about the Hamilton story is that it's not about classics, but it does still kind of track some of the hero narrative stuff. It also is very similar in some ways to the way that the ancient Romans thought about the founding of their city. In particular, they focus a lot on stories of the founding of Rome and what that meant, and the killing, you know, like the war between two brothers and all of that at a moment when they were also themselves in turmoil, where they were coming out of a long protracted series of civil wars. And so then when Augustus first, you know, when Augustus wins and he finally kind of puts an end to all of this, this bloody infighting, then you have, you know, Virgil's Aeneid, looking back to Aeneas and how he came from Troy to settle in Italy. And then eventually, you know, the founder of Rome would be born, or Livy, who was the historian also writing at that time, saying, I'm going to go back to the very beginnings from the founding of Rome and talk about our history all the way through. And so when we're in these moments of turmoil and change, we look to our beginnings to explain how we got here. But what that beginning, where that beginning starts, what it means, that oftentimes changes depending on, you know, it's a story about the people who are telling the story more than it is about the actual origins. And what's so useful about Hamilton is that it started, you know, when it was under the Obama administration, and it, nothing changed about the show. The words, the music, the performances, nothing changed about that show from the Obama era to the Trump era. And yet the meaning of the show changed.
Superb point. And it's about historical context, right? The context has changed, as you're saying. And also a superb point, I think an important insight about how in moments of crisis, we want to go back to origin stories, but we need to be thinking about those, the genesis of those, the origins of those origin stories and how they can, their meanings can change over time as context changes.
And even from, you know, its performance on Broadway to now when it came out on Disney Plus, the meaning of that story changed again. And so in the context, not Rushmore, in the context, you know, that all the, you know, that the show is very, it celebrates America and its promise, and it feels different, you know, and there's no native people in there. And yeah. And so there's it raises the uncomfortable, I mean, now raises the uncomfortable kind of thought that anything that celebrates America is at odds with recognizing the traumas perpetrated on indigenous mm-hmm. peoples. And so it's
right.
It's very complex in and of itself as a show, but it's also complex in terms of the context outside of the show and the way that we think about its role. And so that's what I love about it. It rewards thinking about carefully.
We need to do a course just on Hamilton at some point. We really do. I couldn't agree more. I know we've both seen it multiple times, including in the most recent iteration on Disney+. I don't want to end without asking you to say a little bit about classics at Gustavus. So imagine you're speaking to a prospective student. Why classics at Gustavus? Why at least take a course or two, if not major, in classics at Gustavus?
I think that the Greek, Latin, and Classical Studies department at Gustavus has something for everyone. Because the field of classics is, by its nature, the way it's been defined historically, interdisciplinary. If you have any interest in, stories in the past, in people who are similar or different from you, in languages and the ability to think critically in a very nitpicky, detailed ways, it can provide you with a window into all of these things. But it also kind of, because, for good and bad, because classics has been a privileged subject for centuries, right? There's a value added of knowing that whatever you learn, it's going to pop up again somewhere else in your art history classes, in your English classes, in your history classes, in your philosophy classes. So there's a built-in strand of connection that if you recognize it, you can be able to take advantage of. And again, this isn't an argument against taking something that's completely unrelated. There's a lot of value in that too. But I think that the classics does offer that. And I think that our faculty have lots of different diverse perspectives and ways of teaching and passions and interests that students can find classes, teachers, whatnot, who will be able to encourage them. And I think that our department is especially interested in fostering students' skills because it's a small enough major that you can get a lot of attention, a lot of attention from your professors. It's really a great place to grow.
And your majors go on to do all kinds of interesting things, contrary to the stereotype. What could you do with a history major, a classics major, English major? Not true, right? They're all over the place in successful careers and rewarding careers. I just love your quote about connections. You've come back to that a couple of times in our conversation. I think that's so important. It really sums up what teaching and learning are all about. It's definitely central to the work of historians. And I remember it was some years ago, there was a big exhibit on Leonardo da Vinci. Maybe it was in Chicago. It might have been at the Museum of Science and Industry. But I remember one theme of that show was exactly what you're talking about in that quote. I mean, Da Vinci's ability to make connections or see connections across seemingly disparate, unconnected things. And I think that's so powerful. And I do think classics and really any major at Gustavus nurtures that ability to make connections in students. But you're especially good at it. There's more I want to talk about, but we don't have time, so we'll have to continue this, maybe another podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk, and see you back on campus, I hope, in person.
Yes, thank you very much, Eric. This has been fun.
Yeah, it's great, Yuri. Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.